Hi, this is Jackie Collins, author of The Power Trip, and I'm having a fabulous time today talking to Mr. Media, so enjoy.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to New York Times bestselling author William Kent Kruger, whose latest novel, Ordinary Grace, is a departure from his bestselling Cork O'Connor series. Stick around, and don't go betting against Methodist families from New Bremen, Minnesota. And you can quote me on that. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview. The show is brought to you today by Amazon.com, the world's greatest store for everything from books and movies to computers, TVs, and even my favorite soft drink, Pepsi Wild Cherry. Thinking about buying something online from Amazon or just want to do a little window shopping? You can save yourself a lot of money and help support Mr. Media, that's me, by clicking on one of the Amazon ads at MrMedia.com and start your shopping with us. Get yourself the new iPad or Kindle Fire. Feeling a little racy today? Amazon's got what you need to feel exciting and new, as they used to sing on The Love Boat. Remember, start your next shopping trip from the comfort of your own home, car, hotel, or office with Amazon.com at MrMedia.com. That's right, MrMedia.com. And folks, thanks for your support. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of male narrators who tell their stories much better 40 years later than they ever would have as teens in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. The first book I read by William Kent Kruger, Vermilion Drift, sat a while on my shelf before I started it. And once I began, I must admit that I put the Cork O'Connor mystery down several times. Now, the story, or maybe it was just that title, just didn't immediately compel me. But it came strongly recommended, and I stubbornly kept coming back to it. And about 75, maybe 100 pages in, Vermilion Drift grabbed me by both shoulders and wouldn't let go until I reached the last page. Now, I admit to this because when Kruger's latest novel, Ordinary Grace, appeared in the mail, I didn't hesitate. Smart move, that was. This new story is completely different than the last, but its writing is even better. This time, I got about two-thirds through the book in a day or two and stopped myself, as I often do, so as not to inadvertently give away the ending when I talk to the author, who's about to join us. Now, Ordinary Grace is set more than 50 years ago in New Bremen, Minnesota, an imaginary, small rural community whose life and breath will be instantly familiar to anyone who grew up in such a place. The narrator is Frank Drum, one of three children of the town's Methodist minister. Now, Frank is telling his story of the summer of 1961 as an adult, but his recall and understanding of the way life looked back then to a teenage boy will strike a chord with anyone, like myself, whoever was one. And sometime during the course of the conversation that will follow, the author will read a passage from his book, which will be quite a treat. William Kent Kruger, welcome back to Mr. Media.
Thanks for having me, Bob. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks for not hanging up when I admitted that it took me a while to get into Vermilion Drift. But I feel like I was on safe ground there because I think I acknowledged that the last time we spoke. So, you know.
Yeah, and as long as by the end of the book you were captured by it, that's all I care about.
Well, if I wasn't, we wouldn't be having this conversation, my friend. So now I've read that Ordinary Grace is not a memoir per se. And right there on the cover, it says a novel. But it just feels like a real person's experiences and reminiscences. And so I wonder, should the reader of Ordinary Grace wonder at all what's real and what isn't?
Boy, if I've done my job correctly, yeah, absolutely. They ought to be asking themselves, is this Kent Kruger's life that we're reading about? You know, I think that's the result of the fact that one of the first seeds for the composition of Ordinary Grace was simply that. I wanted to write a story that would allow me to go back in my own adolescence and remember, recall, recreate that period of time, the emotions, the... I don't know if it's this way for women, but certainly for men, that period of time, 12, 13, 14 years old, is an extremely important and difficult time emotionally, because you're leaving childhood and you're not quite into manhood yet. And so that transition, that threshold you stand on, is just a very confusing period of time. I remember that period of my life extremely well, which is probably why ordinary grace, at least for you, strikes a chord that's very familiar. Because I mined my own memories, my own recollections, my own emotions to create Frank Drum. Mm.
Yeah, it seems like, as I'm thinking about Frank, he's at that point where he still does some things on instinct that he knows will get him in trouble perhaps.
Yeah.
He knows that he shouldn't do, but he does them anyway, and yet he's thinking about them. He's at that age where he's not just doing them to do them. He's doing them, and at least he's thinking that there could be consequences, and then he does them anyway.
Yeah, you know, do we ever get over that? I still find myself doing that a little. I find myself very good at saying I'm sorry. Yeah, you know, Frank, he acts like a child sometimes, as a child would act, without any forethought. What he does, he does. But then you're right, afterward he thinks, oh my God, what did I do? And, oh no, this is really going to get me into trouble. And also he thinks not just selfishly about himself, but he thinks about the larger picture. How does what he has done fit into the larger picture? And that's where he's starting to become that man.
Right. Yeah, we see the maturity as the pages turn. And we also see in his younger brother, Jake, maybe the decisions that Frank should have made. You know, Jake seems to be learning from what his brother does day by day.
Jake sometimes, do you remember the movie Walt Disney's Pinocchio?
Sure.
Jake occasionally is the voice of Jiminy Cricket. He's sort of the conscience here. Should we be doing this, Frank?
I could definitely see that. Now, in my head, you know, as we talk about wondering what's real and what's not in the book, I'm going to guess that I'm on good ground, guessing that the deaths in the book, those are clearly fiction. You're not hiding any deaths from childhood.
No skeletons in the closet.
Okay. But I'll use the term that my daughter brought home from high school English class a year or two ago that I actually hadn't heard before. It seems like a lot of the internal narrator, that's the turn of phrase, in the book, which is Frank, as an adult writing about being a teen, that a lot of that could have been actually real things that you thought about and went through in your own head.
I think that's one of the reasons I'm a writer. When I conceive a story, I have that ability, and most writers that I know also have this ability, to sink ourselves into the complete imagining of the story, which is what allows us to bring it to life for the reader. If we can't experience it ourselves, if we can't imagine it completely, in a very tactile, sensory kind of a way. So, you know, we smell, we touch, we hear, we taste. And it's what I try to do is simply bring all of those senses to bear on the imagining of an experience. And I think also the one thing that makes really fine writers, and I'm not saying I'm a fine writer.
You're pretty good.
Is that ability to imagine emotions, other people's emotions, that compassionate part of ourselves where we can empathize and tap into that and then present it to the reader as if we ourselves are feeling that.
Now you are, I think it's safe to say, a very thoughtful, often introspective writer. I don't know if you like that in person, but certainly, you know, when you're at the keyboard, that comes across. But what I have to ask after reading this book is, what were you actually like as a teen?
I was less trouble than Frank. I was the kind of kid whose parents, when they found out their daughters were going to date me, we're really happy about it. Now, he's not going to give us any trouble.
Yeah.
But I always wanted to be more like Frank. I always wanted to be a kid who was really willing to go out there on the edge, you know? Even though you knew you were going to catch it for whatever you did, you went ahead and did it. That wasn't me. I was always worried about what I was going to catch.
I would say that I was probably a lot more like you, the person, and always wanted to be somewhere between Frank and, say, Morris Engdahl.
Yeah. Did any of us really want to be Morris Engdahl? We wanted his car, for sure.
We wanted his car. We wanted his girl.
Yeah, his girl.
We wanted his girl.
He's got a pretty hot girl there.
Yeah, yeah. He may not have been thinking in using the word hot at the time, but the emotion was clearly there.
Yeah.
He had good taste in cars and women. He just...
Well, that was one of the things that was fun about this, is because Frank is a kid just really discovering his sexuality. So he's very aware of all of the nuances and the mysteries and all of that. So what he watches transpire between Morris Engdahl and Engdahl's girlfriend is just, you know, for me as a writer, that was so much fun to write. Because, you know, I could really tap into all of those questions and wonderments that I had at that age.
I particularly liked when Frank pushes Morris into the water. Once and gets away with it, but he does it again. And I thought, man, you know, I can think of once or twice where, you know, some bully took me on and I got in a lucky shove or ducked or something good happened. And boy, you just live on that. You can live on that for months and years. And, you know, those were a couple of special moments, I thought, for good
old
Frank.
That was one of my favorite scenes in the book. And I have to tell you, when I was writing it, I didn't know he was going to push me in a second time, but it just felt right.
Yeah, it just did. It was like, wow, I wonder where this is going to go. And then suddenly he's in the water again. That was great. I love that. And obviously people who are watching this and haven't read the book yet, go read the book so you know what we're talking about, and then come back. So speaking of Frank and Morris Engdahl, who's kind of the town bully, he's kind of like if Fonzie had really gone bad, I guess.
Yeah, he's back, what back in the day we would have called a hood.
He was a hood, definitely a hood. Not in the hood, he was a hood.
He was a hood.
One of the things I really liked about the book is it thrives on multiple kind of one-on-one relationships. There's Nathan, which is Frank's dad and the town minister, and Gus, who cleans up around the church and is sort of his buddy from back in the Army, World War II, sort of not, sort of is. There's Gus and Doyle, who's the cop, Frank and Jake, the two brothers. There's Ruth, Frank's mother, and Emil, who is kind of the town artist, the composer. Won't say anything more about that. There's Emil's sister, Lise, and Jake, Frank's younger brother. That's an interesting one-on-one dynamic. And then, of course, there's Frank and Morris Engdahl, who we just talked about. Somehow, these relationships stood out to me in a way that they felt different than maybe I'd seen in other books, where you often will get like one one-on-one relationship or maybe two, but there's a lot of them, and they all have to do with the dynamic of the story, I thought.
One of the things that I'm always aware of when I read a book is how many people are participating in this scene, and what do I have to keep track of? And the more people you have in a scene, the more complicated it becomes. And for me, the less memorable. And so one of the things that I was trying to do really was, in the way that cinema focuses on two people and you get close-ups, and there's that intimacy of what goes on between them, that's what I wanted to accomplish very often with Ordinary Grace. So a lot of what happens is happening between two people at one point. There may be people around them, but it's happening between two people. So that thing that goes on the rock where Frank pushes Engdahl, the important thing there is Engdahl and Frank, although there are other people around. And so that's really where the dynamic takes place. And I think that's what you're picking up on then, is there's always a central dynamic at work in a scene, and there are two actors who are foremost in the forefront of whatever should occur, whatever should come from that particular encounter.
Oh, you know, and I just thought of one other. Frank and is it Warren Redstone?
Warren Redstone,
right. I won't say anything more about that. People get it when they read it. In a minute, I'm going to ask you about reading a little passage from the book. But there's one other thing I want to touch on, and that is Frank's father, Nathan Drum, who's the Methodist minister in town.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, he not only has one church, he has three churches. Is that a small town thing? I mean, that was something I hadn't really encountered before, although it sort of makes sense, out in the rural areas.
Yeah, it's very rural Minnesota. It's very common for a minister to have a number of churches in his charge, simply because there aren't enough ministers to see to one, or a congregation simply can't support a minister on its own. And so several churches share the cost of one minister who sees to the needs of them all. That's a very common situation.
And is it characterized?
Well, it used to be. I don't know if it is anymore,
okay. But
it certainly used to be. In the time when this story is set, it was certainly a situation that was common.
Well, populations have gotten so much bigger now, and even the rural communities, that it might be a little less likely. But I'm sure there's still parts of the country where that's the case.
Yeah, I'm sure.
The other thing about Nathan Drum, the minister, is he seems to feel people very heavily. I mean, he doesn't seem like a martyr, but he takes their individual problems very much to heart and feels personally responsible.
Oh, he's a tremendously compassionate man. He's a very wounded individual. He went away to the war, to World War II, pretty cocky guy, and he came back very changed. And it was a result of all of the horrible things he experienced in the war. And one horrible thing in particular, which we never really find out, what happened? It changed him, but Gus continues to make references to it. So he comes back a man who's just really aware of all the harm that life does to us and that we do to one another. And he's doing his best to try to help people through that.
So now, as I mentioned, I deliberately did not read past I'm up to about page 225. It's a 300 or so page book. I stopped there because I do not want to be responsible for giving anything away. Although now you've answered one question. I wondered if we were going to find out about what Nathan bears so heavily. So, okay, so there's still a few more things I need to learn.
Okay.
So, Kent, maybe this would be a good time to ask if you would mind reading a little passage from the book.
Yeah, what I'm going to read is the one-page prologue for Ordinary Grace, and I'm going to read it for two reasons. One, it's only a page, so not very long. And the other reason is that I'm really proud of this prologue. I'm really pleased with what it does in terms of introducing the story to the reader. This is how I bring readers into Ordinary Grace. All the dying that summer began with the death of a child, a boy with golden hair and thick glasses. Killed on the railroad tracks outside New Bremen, Minnesota, sliced into pieces by 1,000 tons of steel speeding across the prairie toward South Dakota. His name was Bobby Cole. He was a sweet-looking kid, and by that I mean he had eyes that seemed full of dreaming, and he wore a half-smile, as if he was just about to understand something you'd spent an hour trying to explain. I should have known him better, been a better friend. He lived not far from my house, and we were the same age. But he was 2 years behind me in school and might have been held back even more, except for the kindness of certain teachers. He was a small kid, a simple child, no match at all for the diesel-fed drive of a Union Pacific locomotive. It was a summer in which death and visitation assumed many forms: accident, nature, suicide, murder. You might think I remember that summer as tragic, and I do, but not completely so. My father used to quote the Greek playwright Aeschylus, "He who learns must suffer." And even in our sleep, pain, which cannot forget, falls drop by drop upon the heart, until in our own despair, against our will, comes wisdom through the awful grace of God. In the end, maybe that's what the summer was about. I was no older than Bobby and didn't understand such things then. I've come 4 decades since, but I'm not sure that even now I fully understand. I still spend a lot of time thinking about the events of that summer, about the terrible price of wisdom, the awful grace of God.
Very nice. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Now, this book took, I understand, about 5 years to complete. When did the prologue get written?
The end of the book, as it exists now, was the first prologue. So when you get to the end, it'll be interesting to see how you respond to that. But then I decided it was such a better way to wrap up the story that I put that prologue at the end, in the epilogue. It's the epilogue now. And created this as the prologue. And this came in then probably, well after I'd actually begun the book.
Okay.
I came back to this prologue. The more I understood the story and I understood all of the death that was involved and the nature of all of those deaths, then I went back and I created the prologue so that I could give the reader a sense of what was ahead.
Yeah, before we went on the air, I mentioned to you that just earlier today I'd actually talked to another writer, Jackie Collins, and we were talking about a prologue to her book, The Power Trip, and in that it talks about there's a scene between a couple and they're having sex. It's a Jackie Collins book. They're having
figure.
Yeah, I know, right? They're having sex. It's really a fun book, but they're having sex. And then suddenly he is killed, and it kind of leaves
you. It's not the sex that kills him?
Not the sex that kills him. There was a bullet involved.
Okay.
And so one of the things that kept me – I mean, I enjoy her. I admit, I enjoy her books. They're a lot of fun to read. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that kept me turning the pages is that was the prologue. I wanted to know – because it's not clear in the prologue who the couple is and who got shot. I kept turning the page and turning the page. And as she said, about three quarters of the way through, you find out who it is. I said, yeah, I know. By then, I had to finish the book, damn it. So the reason
– a smart writer.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's where I'm getting to. So the reason I ask you about this is when you write a prologue like that, how functional do you want it to be? Do you want it to just give a taste? Do you want it to, be the page turner because someone wants to get to a certain point, or what are you looking for to accomplish?
I think a good prologue can accomplish a great deal. First thing that you want to do, and any writer wants to do this, is immediately grab a reader's interest. You know, you don't have a lot of, if a reader walks into a bookstore, doesn't know what the hell they want to buy, as an author, you don't have a lot of time to sell them your book. So they're going to look at the cover. You hope you have a good cover. They're going to look at the quotes, dust jacket quotes, to see what other people said about this book. They'll read maybe the inside of the dust jacket for the text there to see what the story's about. And then typically what they're going to do is they're going to open that book to probably the first page just to see what kind of a writer you are and maybe what kind of a story you're going to give them. And so if you can, on that very first page, you want to put something that's going to grab their interest. And you can do that in any kind of book. You can have a sex scene going on. Somebody buys it, you know. You can create intriguing characters. You can. One of the things that I wanted to accomplish with this prologue was to give them a sense of the kind of prose they're going to be reading. This is different kind of prose than you would see in a Cork O'Connor novel. The story is going to play out in probably a slower, different way than a Cork O'Connor novel plays out. That said, there's still plenty that you might expect in a suspense novel. There's death of all kinds, accident, murder, suicide, you know, nature. So I wanted to do all of those things as simply as possible with a hope that, yeah, a reader who picks this up in the bookstore reads that first page and say, great, I got to buy this.
As I say, this book, again, correct me if I'm wrong, that it took 5 years to write. What took so long? What was it that, you know, made it take so much time?
The actual writing of it took probably 2.5 to 3 years. Then there was a very long period of time trying to get it through all of the... Okay, so here's the story, Bob, of Ordinary Grace. Many, many years ago, I'm known primarily for the Cork O'Connor Mysteries, the series that I set in northern Minnesota. But the fourth book that I wrote and published was a book not in the series. It was a book called The Devil's Bed, standalone thriller. A good book. I thought it was a really good book. Got great critical reviews, but nobody bought it. And they didn't buy it because it wasn't a Cork O'Connor novel. And readers weren't willing to follow me to a place that didn't have Cork O'Connor in it. Hmm. And my publisher made it pretty clear to me that they really only wanted to see Cork O'Connor novels from me going forward. So when the seed for this other kind of book, Ordinary Grace, came to me, it was a risky proposition. I had contractual obligations to meet. There was no guarantee that if I spent a lot of time writing it, that I could even sell it. But it was a story that finally I couldn't turn away from. I had to write it. So I sat down, and between my contractual obligations over about 3 years, whenever I wasn't working on a Cork O'Connor novel, I was working on Ordinary Grace. And that's really why it took so long, because I couldn't focus my time completely on it. So I would write to a certain place, jump back to meet my Cork O'Connor obligations. When that was completed, I would go back to Ordinary Grace.
Okay, because I wondered if you know, Cork was, during that period of time, if Cork was, you know, kind of jealous of the attention you were giving to the Drum family, and maybe if he was kind of whispering in your ear, you know, you need someone to come in and solve a mystery. That's what I do, Kent.
Plainly and simply, yeah. my agent, when she read the book that I turned, the manuscript I turned in after I completed Ordinary Grace, she said, you know, it's so clear that writing Ordinary Grace has influenced how you write and how you tell a story now.
Yeah.
What can I say?
Well, and, you know, I liked, as I said at the top, I really liked Vermilion Drift, which was a Cork book, and it took me a little while to get into it. Didn't take me any time at all to get into reading this. It just kind of grabbed you. It's so beautifully written. Listen, you're already on the show. I don't need to suck up to you. You're here. But I mean, it actually killed me a couple days ago to put it aside and not keep reading. And as soon as we're done, I am going to finish the damn book tonight.
I love hearing that. Thank you.
You know, it's always great to find something you really want to read. So there's that. What have you learned? You've written, is this the ninth book?
My ninth published novel?
Yeah, how many books are you?
There are 12 published in the Cork O'Connor series, then there's The Devil Bed, The Devil's Bed, and this one. So this is my 14th novel.
Okay.
Published. And I have another one in the Cork O'Connor series that will be released this August.
Great. And so what I was curious about is, do you feel like you have changed in 14 books? Can you point and say, okay, here's something I'm doing differently than I was on the first book, and here's something I'm doing better?
I can't.
No?
I honestly can't do that. A few years ago, my publisher decided that they were going to bring all of my backlist out in a trade paperback edition, as opposed to before that they'd just been the mass markets. In anticipation of that event, I went back and I reread all of the books that I'd written up to that point, and I think there were maybe 8 at that point, with the idea that I would blog about all of the changes that I would make now, knowing what I know about writing and storytelling and the series itself. And I got to tell you, Bob, mostly I just found myself going, man, this guy can really write. He's written good stories.
Oh, man. All right.
I know.
It's all right. Listen, you're honest. That's okay. I'll back you up. This guy can write, you know.
I haven't seen – I'm not conscious of that progression. I am conscious that Ordinary Grace is a very different book than I've ever written before. And it may be a very different book than I'll ever write again. Mm-hmm. But it was a book that spoke to me more passionately than any other project I've ever attempted. And I wanted so passionately to get it right.
Well, you did good. You did good. So let me ask you, before we kind of wrap up, are you at your desk?
No.
Ah.
Well, yes. I'm at a place where sometimes it functions as my desk.
Okay.
My desk is in a coffee shop 2 blocks away from here. That's where I do all of my writing. Then I come home, and this is where I do my business. I'm actually at my dining room table.
Oh, okay. All right.
So this is where I – because this is the only place I can get the signal from my Wi-Fi. So this is where I do all my business.
Got it. Okay. I was going to – the reason I asked is I wondered if you were at your desk, if there was anything that was particularly important to you at your desk that you like to have nearby or that might be interesting for your readers to know about. But that's okay.
No, my real – I have a desk in another room, and it's like – stacked that high with papers and clutter and everything. I haven't seen the surface of that desk in years.
Got it. So is it publicly known what coffee shop you spend all your time writing in?
Yeah, I pretty much have been willing to acknowledge where I write. For a while, I was a little reluctant to do that. For years and years and years, I wrote at a coffee shop here in St. Paul called the St. Clair Broiler, and I became really associated with the Broiler. I would do media interviews there and photo shoots there and all of that. Had a great relationship with the folks there. But for a variety of reasons, we severed that relationship about 4 years ago. So I went to another coffee shop, and for a while didn't want to know that that's where I wrote, because I kind of liked the anonymity. But word got out, and I now acknowledge the coffee shops that I write at in my book, so everybody knows that's where it is.
So do you want to tell us where it is?
It's a little place. I write in two places, really. One of them is the place called the Java Train. It's just two blocks away from here. And the other place is a place called Common Grounds, which is a coffee shop about six blocks from here. So I alternate between the two.
Point out that he didn't mention the word Starbucks.
I try to support my local independents.
There you go. That's what they want to hear, too. That's very nice of you. Well, folks, listen, you can find Ordinary Grace, the terrific, and I mean terrific, new William Kent Kruger novel in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com. If you're watching this interview or listening to it on the Mr. Media page, just a little further down the page, you should see the cover of the book. You can just click on it with your mouse, and it'll take you to Amazon.com. You can order the book, and you can help Mr. Media out a little bit there, too. What about is there a website for the book, or do you send people to your own website? Where do you want them to visit you?
Yeah, they can certainly visit my author page on Facebook, or they can visit my website, www.williamkentkruger.com. I've got a lot of blog material there, lots of interesting links to other things that readers might find of interest. Yeah. It's a great website.
There you go. It's a great website. And there's a video on there, too.
It does. I had so much fun making the promo video for Ordinary Grace.
And don't you wish that a couple generations ago that we could have had Hemingway and Faulkner John Steinbeck doing videos for their books? Wouldn't that have been awesome?
Wouldn't that be great now to look at those guys on film and, oh, that's what he sounded like. That's what he looked like. That's how he handled himself. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I think Midnight in Paris is the Woody Allen movie is about as close as we're going to get.
One of my faves.
Yeah, it's a great film. Anyway, well, William Kent Kruger, thank you for joining us again and coming back to Mr. Media, and I hope you'll come back again.
Well, I had a ball, Bob. I hope you invite me back.
Absolutely will. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
You can see and hear almost 1,000 Mr. Media interviews by visiting our main site, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. Or check out the more than 200 video interviews on the Mr. Media radio site on YouTube. And I'd sure appreciate if you'd show some love for Mr. Media's advertisers, including Stitcher. Apple named Stitcher a top 5 news app of 2011. It's a free mobile app for your smartphone or tablet that lets you listen to your favorite shows and discover the best of news, entertainment, and sports on demand. You can listen whenever you want to more than 5,000 shows, get customized recommendations, and discover what your friends are listening to. My own list of Stitcher favorites is pretty eclectic. I start my day with an hour of MSNBC's Morning Joe with Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski. Then it's the latest 2-minute update from the Onion News Network. After that, I'll listen to WTF with Mark Maron, Here's the Thing with Alec Baldwin, HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher, and excerpts from E's Chelsea Lately and The Soup with Joel McHale. Also in regular rotation on my Stitcher playlist, The BS Report with ESPN's Bill Simmons, The TechCrunch Headlines, and The Don Geronimo Show. The latest episodes of each show, whether originating from broadcasts, cable TV, radio syndication, or podcasts, are continuously updated. Stitcher is a free app for your iPhone, iPad, Kindle, Fire, BlackBerry, Droid, and more. And show your support of Mr. Media by getting, did I mention it's free? The app at stitcher.com/Mr. Media. That's stitcher.com/MR Media. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. We're also supported by Audible. Check out Audible's 30-day trial membership and download the audiobook version of the book everyone's been talking about, 50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James. Sign up for your free trial today at audible.com/radio. Again, audibletrial.com/radio. And finally, if you need a disc jockey for a wedding, bar mitzvah, corporate event, or just a big old party, please consider calling 1-800-DIAL-DJS, the party authority for all your party entertainment needs. You can call 1-800-DIAL-DJS or go to their website, 1-800-DIAL-DJS.com, and tell them Mr. Media sent you. And thanks for listening. Today's episode of Mr. Media Interviews is brought to you by GoDaddy.com. You know GoDaddy.com from their wild and sexy commercials, but isn't it time you actually test drove their web hosting and domain registration services yourself? For a limited time, Mr. Media listeners can save 10% on the already low price of web hosting services at GoDaddy.com by entering the promo code POD4 at checkout. Again, that's 10% off web hosting when you go to GoDaddy.com and enter the promo code POD4, that's P-O-D, the number 4, at checkout.